This meeting is now being recorded.
All right. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the RPM Subteam for Trademark Claims Data Review call on Wednesday, the 6th of February, 2019. In the interest of time, there will be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you're only on the audio bridge at this time, could you please let yourself be known now? Okay, hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn it back over to Julie Hedlund. Please begin, Julie.
Oh, thank you very much. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. And I see actually that there's a question in the chat. Brian is asking if the call will be recorded. Indeed, it will be. The calls are all recorded. It will also be transcribed. But thank you very much, and thank you all for joining. And just as a reminder to everyone, we will end this call at 5 minutes to the top of the next hour to allow people who are on the following call to be able to transition. So just to remind you all of the agenda, which you see is posted in the agenda pod, the first item is to review the agenda and to ask about statements of interest. Then we'll go to the analysis of the first four source documents of the previous collected data with respect to the claims charter questions. And following that, going through to, and that's questions 1 through 5, following that, we have any other business. May I ask if anyone has any other business? George Kirikos, please go ahead.
Yeah, George Kirikos for the transcript. Obviously, there's been discussion in the past week about the workload, so that should be discussed, as well as the work plan in terms of the schedule for what's required of members, both of the subteam and of this TDP. There seems to be mixed messages. At times, the process is being described as a proposed process, in which case that means ignoring the deadline of this Friday to submit additional data and also the deadline for individual work plans. At other times, it's described as the actual plan because, you know, we've got these forms and so on. And so I'd like to know what's going on and what other people are actually doing because, as I pointed out on the mailing list, we've got over 250 pages left. Like this week's homework assignment was 27 pages, and only a handful of people, myself, Griffin, Christine, Kathy, seem to be putting the input into the doc, into the Google Docs. I don't see anybody else doing that. So tell me what's going on. Tell me what I'm doing wrong, in other words, by raising this issue. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, George. So that would be fair to say any other business would be workload and timeline. Thank you, George, for confirming. Then let me go back to the top of the agenda and ask if there are any updates to statements of interest. I'm not seeing any hands. I'm not seeing anything in the chat, so there are no updates. And then let me move on to agenda item 2 and the analysis of the first four source documents of previously collected data. And I will then turn things over to our co-chair for today, Martin Silva. Martin, please.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much.
We're having an echo. I don't know who is it.
It is now gone. Thank you.
Okay.
Please proceed.
I go again. Hello all, this is Martin Silva-Valen for the record. Richard couldn't make it to the call for urgent personal matters, so you're stuck with me today. I would like you to know we have been working very hard with staff and all the current co-chairs of this working group to sort out the best way to move forward. So any feedback or ideas you might have is more than welcome. Today we're going to work on the review of pre-release collected data, like with the survey data staff produce a PDF with the members' findings. Since the staff summary has already been on the online tool for 2 weeks, I don't think we have to go through that again. let's jump right to the members' homework. Like the last time, I will ask members who made the findings to comment on them instead of reading out loud every input and text. So first charter questions, Seth. Is the trademark claim service having its intended effect? Consider the following questions specifically in the context both of a claims notice as well as a notice of register name. A. Is the trademark claim service having its intended effect of determining bad faith registrations and providing claims notice to the main names applicants? B. Is the trademark claim service having any unintended consequences such as deterring good faith the main names applications? No, George, I'm sorry, but not all of us know the questions by heart, so this is part of leveling the field for those who might not know the questions by heart. But we are saving time with you summarizing your comments. I know the first comment we have in the PDF is Christine Durain. Christine, if you want to come first and tell us about your comments or findings in these specific questions, please go ahead, and if not, we can open the queue for any other members that want to share their findings, whether are in the PDF or not.
Thanks, Martin. This is Christine. Sure. I basically summarized in this for this question, I basically looked at three documents at this point. I haven't been able to go further. And the two of them I didn't think offered anything helpful to this charter question. One was the registry responses to the data subteam, which primarily related to sort of protected marks lists. So that was, you know, predominantly not very helpful. Secondly, I looked at the TMCH report from 2013 to 2017, also expectedly not very helpful because the TMCH report typically has to do with the marks in the clearinghouse and doesn't really deal with the claims service. So the only information that I found that might have been helpful is in the questions from the RPMs to the TMCH provider. We asked a lot. There was a question about how many mark plus descriptive word or mark plus 50 list from UDRP cases. I think these were the 50 labels taken from one UDRP cases. And I believe that there was only 370 labels, suggesting that that probably wasn't as used as it might otherwise have been. So I think there are some comments to the original charter questions that thought that this was sort of a bad idea because it gave too much to brand owners. But my suggestion here is that perhaps it is not having a bad faith effect of deterring registrations because there's not very many effective labels. So that was basically the observation that I made, and that was it. Thanks.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Christine, for all the hard work. Does anyone have any specific comment? I have Kathy next in the queue. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, Martin. No comment on Christine's comments. So if anyone does want to comment on that, I'll wait.
Anyone want to jump, Kathy, or if not, I don't see anything happening. Kathy, all yours.
So I wanted to say that first, I always hate starting with this question because it's an umbrella question. It's a conclusory question, and I actually have started working on it after I do more detailed questions because it's really kind of what did we find in the other charter questions. I also wanted to comment that I thought that the four documents today, and for those who didn't read it, they're really interesting. We have questions from the working group to the trademark clearinghouse provider, so to Deloitte, is dated December 5, 2016, and I think that's actually when their answers came back to us. And then we have some follow-up questions that we asked them dated March 5th. We have a TMCH report that runs from March of 2013 to February of 2017. And we have kind of our first compilation of registry responses dated December 13th, 2016. So, of course, we'll get some more registry responses in the recent analysis group data. But this is, I think, our first set of registry responses, and we hear from PIR, Donuts, and AFNIC. And AFNIC, maybe among other things, ran the geo.paris. So both new GTLDs, old GTLDs, legacy GTLDs, and some of the GOTLDs. So I thought these were interesting documents. And you'll see in my comments coming up across these charter questions that I thought there was really some interesting things to be gathered from this, and it helped me connect some dots that I'd been missing. So this idea of looking at the data and looking at the charter questions to me was really valuable. So you'll see in my comments that I talk a lot about unintended consequences, in part because we find that the Deloitte is doing unintended things. I'm not going to go in the order of my comments. I'm going to kind of go in reverse order. But one of the things is that Deloitte is putting design marks into the trademark clearinghouse. You've heard a million times that Paul McGrady and I drafted the trademark claims notice, and you can blame us for all of it. But we didn't anticipate design marks. I can tell you that because the wording of the rules had said word marks. So there was no way we could properly design, if you could even do that, but there was no way we designed the trademark claims notice to talk about the consequences, and we'll see more about this in the detailed questions later. But there's an unintended consequence. We're deterring good faith domain name applicants because we could not have drafted the trademark claims notice for things we didn't intend. And that includes the broad scope of what's going into the trademark clearinghouse, including geographical indicators, marks protected by statute and treaty that often have nothing to do with trademarks at all, and design marks. We did not draft it, so no one's knowing about it. There's no way to know about the scope and limitations. So huge unintended consequences. We're finding things in the trademark clearinghouse that weren't anticipated to be there. Another thing that we're finding, and, you know, Deloitte confirms that we don't have open access to searching the trademark clearinghouse. We knew this, but here it is documented, and that means that councils, trademarks, clinics, anyone working with good faith, entrepreneurial, domain name registrants cannot do traditional research of what's out there, what to avoid, how to prepare for registration of a domain name, and also how to prepare for naming a business or company. I'll stop there. There's also some comments about we appear to be commingling different types of marks in the trademark clearinghouse, which was also not envisioned by the rules. Back to you, Martin. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy, for your input. I have Susan Payne on the queue. Susan?
Yeah, thanks very much. It's Susan here. I put my hand up quite early, and then Kathy didn't go through in the order I was expecting. So she didn't particularly highlight the reason I put my hand up, but I may as well carry on. I suspect Ben Griffin may have some further comments on a lot of what Kathy won't steal his thunder. But just on the first entry from Kathy, she talks about Deloitte not being able to delete marks and that surely that would have unintended consequences of deterring good faith domain name applications. I think that really goes to the that isn't the case. Deloitte did confirm that they don't delete mark records, but that doesn't mean that a mark that is no longer an active mark, for example, because the fees haven't been renewed or indeed if the mark has expired, that doesn't mean that's still working. It just means Deloitte are not deleting their records. It's no longer got an SMD file if it needed one. It's no longer being used to generate claims. It's no longer effective. It has no impact whatsoever. So that's a fundamental attempt at misrepresenting how this actually works. And I know that Kathy knows how this works. We've covered this ground time. Thanks very much.
Susan, if I might, as a point of personal privilege, are you saying that Deloitte has confirmed? I mean, I'm an old database programmer, and I don't know how this works. So I was raising the issue in good faith. But let me ask you, normally, often when old FET records are left in the original database, they are not properly used. I've seen this many times. I was a data security auditor. Can you confirm that Deloitte has responded that these old records are not being used as part of trademark claims or Sunrise? And just to follow up, I don't think there's any revocation of an SMD file. We're going to see that coming up later on in material I think George pointed out. But I would love to know if they've confirmed that. If it is, that's great, and that's an answered question.
Susan?
Goodness, Kathy, I have no idea. I would have to go back through all of these documents to see whether anyone even asked them that question. I'm not sure they did in those precise terms, but they have explained on multiple occasions how the claims service works and how the Sunrise works. And given we're in the claims group, there probably isn't references to SMD files in this context because, of course, they're not applicable to the claims. They're only applicable to the Sunrise. But we have had multiple conversations and multiple explanations of them about how this works. And how these different rights protections are activated and generated.
This is Martin for the record. Thank you very much, Susan and Kathy, for the debate. Griffin, I know you're typing a lot. Do you want to also tell us what you think?
Yeah, thanks, Martin. So I had put my hand up initially to just walk folks through my written input that I had prepared, but and again, as I noted earlier in the chat, inadvertently forgot to actually add to the Google Doc. Instead, given the most recent comments, I will instead try and just reply to some of the most recent points. So on Kathy's first point, and I tied something into the chat to this effect, but I just wanted to mention it again quickly on the point of, you know, the clearinghouse accepting, you know, design marks as, you know, as I understand it, what's actually happening is somebody submits a mark that contains both textual elements and design or device elements. The wording actually varies a bit. And so where there's a discernible textual component of the mark, even if the mark also includes design elements, the clearinghouse will accept it. And this actually makes sense to me in the context of trademark law generally, and also in the context specifically of what this subteam is about, which is claims, which is to basically advise, you know, potential registrants of a potential trademark issue for registering a domain name. Because, you know, the test is ultimately a likelihood of confusion test, at least with respect to infringement. So, you know, if you're using a domain that is the text, and that text, you know, is textual elements in a, you know, a mark that's text and designs, there's still arguably infringement occurring. And so I think for purposes of notifying people of that issue, you know, that seems to make sense. That seems to be logical. And you know, so that's the point I would make in response to that issue. And then, again, on the point of, you know, deleting mark records, et cetera, you know, in the Deloitte follow-up responses, they note that where they've been informed that a mark has been canceled, the mark will be deactivated and the Sunrise and claims services will be canceled within 24 hours. So, again, and this kind of goes back to Susan's point in response to Kathy, but, you know, just because records are not being deleted from the database, I suppose, doesn't mean that they're still, you know, continuing to be active when, you know, they've been identified as no longer being legitimate or what have you. So I think that's been clarified as well. So I'll leave my comments there for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Griffin. We'll welcome you again so you can share your findings. George, you're next on the queue. Please go.
Yeah, George Quirkos for the question. I think I interpreted this question, chart question, differently than other people. I was perhaps reading it more narrowly, and so that's why I agreed with Christine initially that it didn't necessarily answer these questions directly. However, I can see Kathy's point where she seems to focus on maybe a more expansive interpretation of Part B of the chart question, whether it's having any unintended consequences. And so reading that more expansively, I obviously agree with all the issues that she's identified. One of the issues she identified was the adequacy of the claims notice, and I tended to more put that in my answer to charter question three. And so she might want to look at my charter question three answer. I'll kind of give a quick overview of that if you want to flip over to question three. Basically, the claims notice only contained the registrant, as she identified, the marketing registrant, registrant contact jurisdiction, and goods and services. And so if you're a good faith registrant actually wanting to locate the trademark in all the jurisdictions, you're going to have problems in some jurisdictions, because I pointed to an article where, you know, Google, Apple, and others are registering, you know, product names in foreign countries without searchable trademark databases, like Jamaica, Tobago, Barbados. And you're not necessarily going to have enough data to actually find these trademarks, because, you know, they're not searchable. You don't have the registration number of the trademark. You don't know whether it's a figurative mark or whether it's a character mark, and Kathy identified that issue as well. So, you know, people acting in good faith aren't necessarily going to be well served, and so she classifies that as an unintended consequence. I put it more towards claims charter question three, and so I won't have to go over this again when we get to claims charter question three. But we're identifying the same issues, just putting in them in different questions. Thanks.
Thank you very much, George. This is Martin for the record. We have Michael Graham on now. Michael?
Oh, hi. Thanks a lot, Michael Graham, for the record. Two points. One, I agree with what Griffin had posted regarding the discernible elements of design marks, where there are discernible word elements. Blocking the ability to record those discernible word elements in the TMCH actually, from my point of view, would threaten the ability of SMEs, smaller companies that in some instances when they have certain limited resources and will only register a design or a stylized mark that includes the word mark, with the understanding that that registration would protect also the word mark, not enabling them to record with the TMCH actually would cut off those smaller companies, and I'm concerned about that. Larger companies don't have that same issue. On the second point, and addressing both point that Kathy and George just brought up, the Trademark Clearinghouse is not a trademark search tool, nor was it ever intended to be that a company that's looking to adopt a trademark or a business name is not going to look there. They're going to look online. They're going to look at the trademark registries, albeit, as George pointed out, there may be some registries that do not publish or do not have an easily searchable database. I've never found that to be a blocker, but certainly the Trademark Clearinghouse, we should not broaden its importance to be one of determining whether or not to adopt a name or a mark, because if it's recorded there, it's also registered somewhere that would be discoverable with a search. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Michael. Christine noted in the chat that we should focus specifically on data sources, and she is right. So I know the context is relevant, and we, of course, everything we saw builds up towards the final discussion, but the final discussion will be done later. So to all speakers, do remember to try to not stray. Thank you. Rebecca Tashnet, you are next.
Rebecca Tashnet, thank you. I think the expressed concern for SMEs is misleading in this context, because there are lots of reasons that different kinds of entities get marks, but in general, people seek word marks when they can get word marks, because word marks provide a broader scope of rights through the registration. When someone has only a registered design mark, then their rights are, as far as the registration is concerned, centered on that design mark, not on individual components. And it may well be that there's a greater scope to that, but we don't the point of the system was to identify something specific, which was a registered mark, and they don't have that in the word. And in fact, and I think Kathy is exactly right to point to a significant consequence of this, which is as applied to design marks, the notice that people get, that attempted domain name registrants get, is wrong and misleading because it indicates that there's a registration covering the letters that they've tried to register, and there isn't. And so that makes it even harder for someone to figure out what the scope is. You know, it's already not a particularly helpful statement, but now we're getting even further away from the actual truth of the matter. And, you know, if there's enough potential conflict, you know, that in a likely confusion proceeding, we would evaluate the factors, that's not the standard. This is supposed to be for really clear conflicts, and when you have a design mark, that's not what you have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. Kathy, you are on.
Hi. So I'm not going to, based on Christine's request, I'm not going to talk anymore about design marks because I think it's covered and that there is data that's very relevant on this. To the charter question, is the trademark claim service having unintended consequences such as deterring good faith domain name application? B, a different aspect of that, and it is, again, in these materials, is that the database is closed. That was not the intention. Trust me, the STI did not want to close database. There were certainly some who did. That was not what was created. That was done later. The rules adopted by the GNSO Council and the board were open. So, yeah, huge unintended consequences of deterring good faith domain name applications. And let me tell you why. What we found, first, that Deloitte has confirmed it. That's the data. We knew it, but, you know, it's here in these materials, and it's very relevant to these claim questions. So what it means is that as an SME attorney, and I did that for 20 years, you can't check where the problems are, and you're certainly, as an SME attorney, you have no resources to check the entire world. What you would do is go to every major database, and that would include the TMCH. That's what was envisioned by those who created the rules. And so it prevents you from getting that turn away at the end when you actually go to register the domain name, and you're standing on your client standing on one foot looking at the TM claims notice. So that's a real problem. So the closeness as well as the registration of design mark. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Kathy, and thank you for staying on topic. George, you're next, unless Rebecca. No, that's an old hand. George, you're on.
That's a new hand. George Griggs is trying to say that's a new hand. Yeah, just to reinforce what Rebecca and Kathy are saying, I see in the notes an action item that says the TMCH wasn't intended to be a trademark search tool. Anything recorded in the TMCH would be discoverable via a search elsewhere. So something being, you know, potentially available to be found is not the same as, you know, being uniquely identified. And I make this point in the section charter question 3 document. You can have, for example, a figurative mark that's in the TMCH, and you can have that mark holder have multiple figurative marks for the same text. Like, let's say it's Michelob, just to pick an example. That's probably a bad example, but Michelob might have, you know, 20 different logo marks that are figurative marks, and one of them might be the basis for a TMCH record. And so which one is it? we don't know, you know. The person receiving the claim doesn't actually know. And why is it of their interest to know? Well, maybe that mark was revoked. Maybe it expired. And so, you know, how are they supposed to know whether to take that claim notice seriously if they actually can't uniquely identify it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, George. This is Martin Slough for the record. Greg, I see you are next, please.
Thanks. Greg Chatton for the record. Seems truth is somewhat relative, unfortunately. I've also had the pleasure of representing small and medium-sized companies, often a very limited trademark budget dictates that you need to decide, you know, how if you're only going to file one trademark registration or application, rather, would you file it for the stylized form of your word of your mark, or the text-only form, or a composite with a logo, and not all of the above, which is, you know, a luxury for that larger companies can afford, but smaller ones can't. Similar, and also, a design mark, or I'd say, let's say a stylized mark, a figurative mark, a composite mark with design elements, does protect the words. There's, you know, nuance to be discussed there, but the idea that it is not protectable goes way too far in trying to understand the issue, and I think it's, you know, quite germane and appropriate that marks with design elements and stylized marks and the like are in the TMCH. We have narrow issues we've discussed that we've identified potentially, which are those where the mark itself is disclaimed and those where the mark is no longer valid. Those are interesting concerns. They're appropriate concerns. If we have data that goes directly to those concerns, it would be great to identify them. But just using the data as a jumping off point or a talking point is not really going to get us very far with the data. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. I would like to see if we can get to question two, but I know that we have a Griffin comment. Griffin, would you like to tell us the input that you didn't manage to get into the document?
Yeah, hi, Martin. This is Griffin for the record. I'm happy to just quickly note what my input on question one here is, and again, apologies for not timely getting into the Google Doc, but I will add it following this call once the document is unlocked again. But it was just two very quick points. I noted that Christine basically said there's not a lot of data here or no data here that helps us answer these questions, and I know Kathy had inserted some data that she believes helps answer these questions. I found just two you know, small pieces of information that I thought were relevant to this question. The first was from the initial set of responses from Deloitte, in which they state, based on our customer support team experience, most of the questions relate to the actual trademark management, such as, I have received a claim notification, what do I do now? Which to me suggests some potential confusion regarding the meaning of claims notices and also the trademark and also the TMCH provider's role in administering them. Which I think goes to the issue of intended versus unintended consequences. And then secondly, something which I mentioned earlier from the sort of follow-up responses that Deloitte provided, which is the fourth document, they say when a trademark holder informs the TMCH that a mark has been canceled, the mark will be deactivated and the Sunrise and claim services will be canceled within 24 hours. And again, I think that's relevant to the issue of potential unintended consequences, particularly, you know, whether marks that may no longer be valid continue to receive the benefits of claims, at least in this case, and potentially Sunrise, but that's for the other subteam. And so those are the two quick data points that I was able to find in this particular set of documents that I thought were relevant to question one. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Griffin. Unless someone has any specific comments to what Griffin said, let's move to question two. Since I see no hands up. Okay, do we have question two on the Adobe? It's loading. Okay. So, claim charter question two, if the answers to claim charter question 1A is no or 1B is yes, or if it could be better, what about the trademark claims notice and or the notice of registered name should be adjusted, added, or limited in order for it to have its intended effect under each of the following questions? A, should the claims period be extended? If so, for how long? Up to permanently. Should the claims period be shortened? Should the claims period be mandatory? Should any TLDs be exempt from the claims RPM? And if so, which ones and why? Should the proof of the use requirement of for Sunrise be extended to include the issuance of a trademark greenhouse notices? I see here we have only two comments, and both of them basically say they don't find any relevant data from this source for this question. So unless anyone wants to add something specifically or the members that didn't find anything wants to comment on it, I don't have anything else to add. To add regarding this question. So I opened the queue. I assume that was an old hand, Greg. Griffin says that he agrees that there is no relevant data in this document for this question. I will wait a few seconds so we can finish typing if they want to put something in the chat. Okay. Since we don't have anyone in the queue, and we don't have anything else to add to this question, let's wait. We have more input from other sources. Let's move to question three then. Give me 1 second here. Claim charter question three. A, does the trademark claim notice to the main names applicants meet its intended purpose? One, if not, is it intimidating, hard to understand, or otherwise inadequate? If inadequate, how can it be improved? Two, does it inform the main names applicants of the scope and limitations of trademark holder rights? If not, how can they be improved? Three, are translations of the trademark claims notice effective in informing domain name applicants of the scope and limitation of trademark holder rights? And B, should claims notifications only be sent to registrants who complete domain name registrations as opposed to those who are attempting to register domain names that are matches to entries in the trademark clearinghouse? Here we have George Kirkus first, so I'll ask him if he wants to comment on his findings. If not, we can move to someone else. George, would you like to?
George, quick question for the transcript. Yeah, this is exactly what I said when we were talking about chart question number one. So I don't really have anything you'd add. That's all been said. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much, George. We have also Kathy. Kathy, you're next.
Sure. So not sure if all been said, because this is where we're really diving in. Does the trademark claims notice, does the data tell us anything about whether it meets its intended purpose? It absolutely doesn't. Is it intimidating, hard to understand? We've already dealt with that issue, but is it inadequate? We're going to get to that one in big form in the data today. And does it inform domain name applicants of the scope and limitations of the trademark holder's rights? No, because we're about to talk about people who are trademark holders. So let me just summarize, again, it's just fascinating to kind of think about the history of this and then look at these documents and then look at the charter questions as we've revised them. This is really the first time we're pulling this all together. So my comments, I say, and I'm going to read them because I know many people are just sitting there reading them right now. We have a problem. What information is the claims notice providing when the TMCH registration is not a trademark, but a geographical indication, a protected designation of origin, or a protected appellation of origin? What is shown on the claims notice is not going to possibly inform the domain name applicant of the scope and limitations of the trademark owner's rights, for there is no trademark owner, and these are very complicated and contested rights in the international sphere. So that, the note that the trademark claims notice was never drafted for these types of situations because they weren't supposed to be in the trademark clearinghouse. That's why it's called the trademark clearinghouse database. So that we've got a clear problem with these charter marks and also with the design marks, because the claims notice did not anticipate them either. And the trademark claims notice makes no mention of design marks, does nothing to share the full design mark, does not print out the design or logo, and accordingly, the notice can't be serving its intended purpose because the right materials are not being delivered to inform anyone. I know we talked about this in the earlier question, but let's talk about geographical indications and other types of non-trademark rights that are now there, and presumably the trademark claims notices are pointing some of those out. Data on this. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Do we have anyone else who wants to add a comment on this? I know there are some comments on the chat. Griffin is on the queue. Griffin, you're next.
Yeah, thanks, Martin. This is Griffin for the record. I'll just summarize what my written input will be. I thought, again, there was a very small amount of relevant data for this question. The first data point, which is also something that I mentioned in connection with question one, but which I thought was also relevant to this question, was the point from the first set of Deloitte responses, which said that from their customer support team experience, most of the questions they received related to trademark management issues, including questions about from people who received a claims notification asking, you know, what do I do now, which, again, I think goes to the point of whether the notice is hard to understand, et cetera. And then secondly, the other data from this set of documents that I thought was relevant to this question was basically just Deloitte summarizing what is in the claims notice, and they say the third party is informed of a record in the TMCH or the claims notice, which is presented prior to registration. So that actually first relates to the timing, which is sub-question B, of when the notice is delivered. And then the claims notice holds the mark name, registrant, and registrant contact, and the jurisdiction and goods and services of the mark recorded in the TMCH. Again, that's just a factual summary of what is presented in the notice, which does relate to sub-question A2, again, just sort of from a factual perspective in terms of what's presented currently. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Griffin. This is Martin Hill for the record. Susan Payne, you're next, please.
Thanks. Hi, it's Susan. I really just have a question about what the scope of this exercise is meant to be. Because my understanding is we're meant to be those of us in this working group, and it wasn't me who had time to do this exercise this week. But you know, we're meant to be looking at these specific documents and pulling out the information from them, which goes to help answer the particular charter questions. And I didn't think we were supposed to be kind of setting out our stall, you know, and advocating our particular positions. And it seems to me that a lot of this exercise is just being used to do that. And I'm not sure that this is very helpful. It seems to me it would be more helpful to just pull out what it is in the particular document that one is trying to identify. And perhaps it needs a sentence to explain why it's relevant. But if it needs kind of three or four paragraphs to explain why it's relevant, then that's advocacy. And I think that's something that is meant to come later. I just would like to understand what we're supposed to be doing and how this task is going to be carried on going forward, because we seem to be spending a lot of time listening to people advocate their positions.
Thank you very much, Susan. This is Martin Hill for the record. We are supposed to be finding relevant pieces of data and linking them in a context. Why is it relevant? So we can later discuss whether that impacts or not in our final decision. In the homework, people have identified specifically. For instance, I can see Katie has identified a follow-up questions from Deloitte, and she has quoted them, and same others. So as long as we have identified which specific data they're talking about, I think the exercise is worthwhile. I do agree it's difficult sometimes to separate or to stop people, to stop the thoughts to go into their specific position. But the idea is that they have the freedom to say, okay, there's a piece of data here in this specific document, and it says this. This is what the document is saying, and that's why it's relevant. So as long, and I do ask members to be very responsible on it, is please point out the data, because if you don't, as Susan said, this could be futile. It is only relevant as long as we can identify a specific piece of data so we can later on move. And yes, it's difficult to manage the time each member speaks and when they are strained or when they're going to make a point at the end. Sometimes you only know it at the end. So I do ask self-control and honesty on this. Thank you very much. And we have Kathy next. Kathy?
Okay. Yeah, and of course the precedent for this was set in the analysis group and how we responded to those. So just following suit, somewhat trying. But To Griffin, of course we know it's in the trademark claims notice. Thank you for repeating it. But how does that possibly apply? Sometimes it sounds like advocacy, but sometimes we find facts that are so extraordinary, it just makes us look and say, oh, my God, what is the relevance of the question? Does the trademark claims notice to domain name applicants meet its intended purpose when it's not even dealing with a trademark, when it is dealing with, as Deloitte tells us, a geographical indication, a protected designation of origin or protected appellation of origin? Guys, we're completely off base, and the data shows that we're trying to address X, and there's Y in the database. So that's what's being pointed out here, is that the trademark claims notice does nothing. And hence, we've got kind of extraordinary, clear responses to some of the claims charter questions of stuff that's not trademarks. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Kathy. George, you are next in the queue. Unless someone else wants to get into the queue, George will be the last one, and then we just go to any other business and call it a day.
Yeah, George, for the transcript, I agree with Susan and Griffin and Greg and Christine, who are saying the exact same thing. You know, we should be limiting it to finding those gems, finding, you know, it's been compared to doing mining. I actually would compare it to being garbage picking or sifting through the garbage, trying to find that relevant data and putting it into this document. And the thing is, not enough people are doing that. You know, only 4 people seem to have done that. And you need to put enough into the document that explains why we think it's relevant. So sometimes that might seem like advocacy. But there has to be, a balance between not putting in enough or putting in too much. And hopefully I've met that balance because I've tried to figure out the points very carefully. Thank you.
Thank you, George. Susan, you have the last word on this. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I don't even know how that happened. That's not a hand. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. Thank you. Thank you very much anyway. I do appreciate your comment, and I do agree. It's just that sometimes it's hard to find the right way to herd everyone into that specific task. But so I do appeal for the intellectual honesty that if you're going to comment on something, you re-identify it with piece of data. And if we did let data speak for itself, what do you mean, Greg? We should just point out, go to one and we can later discuss it, because I think that's the idea, to discuss previously whether if that's relevant or not. Again, let's go. We have only 4 minutes left. Let's go to any other business now. We were going to briefly discuss the timeline or the workload. I know that was a problem last week, we have a new timeline. Well, we don't have a new timeline right now. We're working on it, and this call has been sort of, I think, useful. We did move forward compared to the last time, so I do celebrate that, and I do think I thank everyone who participated in this. We are not going to do 4 now because we don't have time. Just in 4 minutes opening that discussion, I don't think it makes sense. Josh, you were the ones that specifically asked for this question in this call, so do you have anything to say? Or
yeah, George Kirkus here. I've kind of already set it on the mailing list, and so, you know, here's the basic question I posted right before this call. What is the current work plan? Some people are saying it's a proposed work plan. Some people are saying that there's a deadline on Friday for a document, or a couple of weeks from now for individual proposals. This is confusing to me. You know, what should I be doing as a good faith member, and why isn't everybody else doing the exact same thing? Thank you.
Anyone else wants to add something? Josh, you have your hand up. Probably that's another one.
George here again. Well, it's a basic question. What is the current work plan? That's something that there should be a definitive answer on. Either that January 29th document is just a proposal, or it's not a proposal. or it is binding and it's been decided. You know, what is the current work plan? Can somebody actually post it? Because it obviously has an impact on how things proceed. Thank you.
We are using the proposed plan so far, but it's not final. And I would prefer staff to send the document to you if you haven't seen it already. And if no one else has anything else to add, we can close the call. We are 2 minutes away from our supposed target, so I think that's a good target. George, is binding us in that we need to move forward with the timeline. So as long as Friday comes and we don't have a change in the proposed plan, it is binding.
That's what I've been, George Rikos here, that's what I've been arguing. In terms of workload, let's talk about that specifically. How many hours of homework are we going to be expected to do every week? Because only, you know, I see Griffin, myself, Christine, Griffin, Kathy, Christine, and myself have been the only ones filling out the document for the most part. You can't throw, you know, 20 hours of work in a week and expect that to get done. Like, what's the expected workload and how does that compare to the 24 hours of staff that it takes? Because next week is supposed to be when we're done. I don't want to see, you know, 20 hours of assigned homework after this call. You know, what's going to be happening for next week?
Julie, I see your hand up.
Oh, thank you very much, Martin. And just to be quick, we have about a minute. So I think as we mentioned last week on the call, and the subteam, I think, specifically asked that the subteam co-chairs should consider whether or not additional calls are needed, meetings are needed to go over the previously collected data. And if we get through to next week's meeting, and I think we understand that and the subteam has indicated that that it's, there's still a lot of work to be done. If we get through next week's meeting and we have more work to do, then it seems clear that there'll be a need for additional meetings, and the subteam co-chairs can consider that and consider the impact on the timeline. So, for example, there could be a scenario, and this is why that's why the timeline and the work plan is evolving. There could be a scenario in which we run through this analysis through to the end of February, for instance. That will change the timeline and the deadlines in the timeline. It will also affect what work is done in COBA. So it really depends on how much the subteams are able to achieve during a meeting, what's reasonable, and whether or not additional time is needed. And go ahead, Martin, and I see that we're 5 minutes to the top of the hour.
Exactly, yes. We don't have any more time to add things, but I do welcome and I do ask everyone to have that has an opinion to send it to the list, because we read it and we use it. So if you're saying we should not do this, or we should go into this, or we should move a deadline, please just tell us. Type it if you have that sensation, idea, or thought. And let's wrap it so people can go to the next call. Thank you very much to everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Today's meeting is adjourned. You can disconnect your lines and have a good rest of your day.